There's plenty of room up front, so if it's crowded in the back, just bring some chairs up here. Don't be shy.
Let me see how it feels.
Okay.
You still see everybody.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a small room.
And
if you could, you use a bit because we record it.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Come to the front. We have 3 seats in the front.
Don't be shy.
Come sit in the front. Three of us, Vanessa. You and your cohort.
If you ever apply to us, we remember who sits in front.
That's right. You want to get a winter grid, down to the chat.
Everybody's down.
Don't you have an application pending? Is it all right?
Yes.
Say that you're doing yourself well. Okay. Okay, if you haven't met me yet, I'm Leslie Aiello. I'm the president of the foundation. I'd like to welcome you all here for our Christmas talk. And we're very happy to see you. Please, take food with you home. And enjoy your time here. I'd like to turn it over to Rudy, who I think is going to do all of the introductions and the logistics.
Well, I'd like to welcome you all here tonight. I think it's a great testament to the power of Silvia Federici's work that we have such a great crowd. And it's especially nice to kind of end our calendar year on a bang like this. So thank you all for turning out. Thank you so much for coming. I'm Rudy Gaudio, and with Jeff Moskovsky, I'm a co-chair of the New York Academy of Sciences, hosted here at Wenner-Gren. And at this time of year, we're also very grateful to our Wenner-Gren hosts. So round of applause for them. They've been hosting us here for a few years, and we're very much at home here, and so we hope you will come back. Plug for our next talk, January 28th, Monday, Doug Armstrong will be talking about the archaeology of slavery in Barbados. So we will have another subfield represented then. Tonight, in a second, I'll be introducing Silvia Federici's talk, but I want to give you a little background on her. As many of you know, probably better than I, she is a formidable scholar, activist, hero with regard to putting forth a Marxist, feminist, and engaged critical, it's not anthropology, it's a critical thinking and doing with regard to global capitalism and its effects in people's everyday lives. In 72, she was a co-founder of the International Feminist Collective, famous for a number of things, including launching the Wages for Housework campaign. And she's been active in that struggle for quite a while, and in a theoretical terms, helping to put forth a notion of reproduction as critical to notions of class struggle. Other work, I can't even, I can't survey the entirety of her work, but some of the key issues that she's been addressing, that one of the things that drew us to her work, I'll say, had to do with her work on the commons and the enclosure of the commons, which has obviously class implications, as well as the ways that she studied that in terms of its gendered implications for patriarchy. And she's looked at that in a number of kind of geographical, cultural, and historical contexts. One title that I rather like in her oeuvre is Caliban and the Witch, Women, the Body, and Primitive Accumulation, which has been translated into like lots of interesting languages that I could read the list if you wanted. That's not the only work of hers that's been translated into a lot of languages. Her work is very powerful and resonates throughout the globe. And they're not only European languages, I'm happy to report. Really a global reach in the work she does. As an Africanist who works in Nigeria, I'm kind of pleased by the fact that she spent a few years teaching at University of Port Harcourt in Nigeria, and helped to found, what's the name of that group? The Committee for Academic Freedom in Africa, which kind of speaks to the engagement she had with her colleagues at the University of Port Harcourt. And I can tell you that many of the struggles you were fighting around then are still relevant to those people now. I actually neglected, oh, no, wait, I didn't. I don't have the title of the talk you said you were going to give tonight. I have the title of the book, that it's fun. So, but I can tell you that her recent book, and the work she's reading from tonight is related to the book. That book is Revolution at Point Zero, Housework, Reproduction, and Feminist Struggle, which includes essays from different periods in her scholarship. And I think we're in for a big treat. I just want to say one last thing. We like to know who's attending so we can hit you up to come back again. So if you could please sign one of the sheets that I'm passing around here, I'd really appreciate it. Thank you.
Is this working? Okay. Okay. Well, thank you, Joe, for your coming tonight. And also thank you to the New York Anthropology Association and to Rudy Gaggio again for inviting me here. What I'm going to do is to present very informally tonight some of the main themes of Revolution at Point Zero. And I will start first of all making some comments about the title of the book, Why Revolution at Point Zero? Fundamentally, I took the title for my book from another book from a famous Egyptian writer, Nawal el-Saadawi. Some of you may know Woman at Point Zero. And if you have read a very, very powerful book, if you haven't, you should really put you on the list. You'll know that Woman at Point Zero is the story of a woman who is basically ready to be hanged. And Point Zero in that moment of her life represents both the moment in which all illusion, all hopes are lost. In fact, the book is a sort of journey through all the possibilities, the options that are open to a woman. The ending and the crime that she commits for which she will be hanged, you know, represents in a way the failure of all those possibilities. But Point Zero also represents something else. It represents the moment when the illusions are gone and when an opening becomes possible, precisely because nothing more is to be hoped from what is there. And in that sense, it is symbolic in the book of a need for a total change. Of the realization on the side of the protagonist that there is no justice in this particular world for women. And so I've taken the title because I thought it would fit properly for what I wanted to say in this book through the collection of these different articles about the question of reproduction and to say both to speak both to the crisis that I see happening at the level of reproduction today across the world, you know, a crisis that I think is deepening by the day and it jeopardizes the life of millions of people. And at the same time, the recognition that it's on the level of reproduction that today the most important transformation, the most revolutionary transformations are taking place. In other words, that if there is a hope for the construction of a new society, that hope must begin and is beginning with work that many people, but I would say women in particular, are doing in many parts of the world on the question of reproduction. Naturally, the question of reproduction itself, the concept is is very broad. I'm using it in a way that goes way beyond the notion of procreation. And not only it's a broad concept, but it's a concept that in the course of the book keeps shifting, keeps changing. In the early part of the book, reproduction refers in particular to domestic labor, housework. But as the book progresses, more and more reproduction refers to all those activities by which life is reproduced and includes not only domestic work and procreation, but also subsistence type of activity, like subsistence farming, sex work. In a sense, it encompasses, again, all the sphere that is essential for the reproduction of life and also for the reproduction of the workforce. Now, why reproduction? I want to mention that my interest in this topic, it's rooted in a profound irony, because in a way I was motivated to study and to become engaged politically around the issue of reproduction by my first early profound refusal of housework. My first profound refusal in my youth of the idea of becoming a housewife. And I begin the book and the preface by an attempt to explain where this refusal came from. And I want to repeat here that I think it was rooted very deeply in the experience that myself, like many women of my generation, you know, had, if not directly, indirectly, through the stories, the tales of our parents, about World War II, about the war. You know, an experience that represented a watershed, you know, as far as women have been concerned and the question of reproduction has been concerned from many, many points of view. In the United States, the accent is always placed on the experience of independence that many women gained during the war because of the fact that men went to war and they had to take on responsibilities they had not previously had. And because for the first time being drafted into industry, into male occupation, they had the experience of a wage, they had the experience of work done in cooperation with other women. In the case of the women of my generation or our mothers, I think the experience was a different one. It was an experience in which independence was not necessarily something that was achieved but was imposed. In the sense that, you know, many women found that the war put them in the position, because so many men died, put them in the position of having to take care of themselves, of having to be responsible for their livelihood. And they transmitted the necessity of self-reliance also to their daughters. And, of course, the war also was a major, major indictment of the political world. It was a major indictment also of a certain male world, the world of male values. It was, in a sense, a break, you know, between, you know, women and the state. It severed, in a way, a certain social pact, silent, unspoken social pact that had prevailed, which stipulated if you were a good wife and mother, you'd have certain guarantees, certain protection, whereas this, the war demonstrated there were no such protection and demonstrated also the futility of producing children, you know, for a society, for a state that would use them as cannon fodder. So I say that it's ironic, my relationship to reproduction, because in a way, out of this deep refusal of housework, it really was one of the dominant features of my youth. You know, I will not become a housewife, which I share with many women of my generation. Actually came an involvement with this concept, came an involvement with the, also the politics of this surrounding this activity that has continued to this day. And it began, first of all, in the women's movement, where the question of housework, reproduction, you know, and what role domestic labor has in the subordination of women in society, in the discrimination that women have been subjected to. All these questions were very, very, very central. I was very fortunate that I joined in the women's movement a group of women who had broad experience, broad political experiences. Some had experience of the anti-colonial struggle. Others, for example, Maria Rosa Dalla Costa, and was coming from the Italian tradition of operaismo, which was an intellectual movement in the 60s in Italy that began a kind of radical critique of the Communist Party, of an historical materialism. And the combination of these different political perspectives created a sort of interesting political framework, political approach, that enabled us to look at some of the issues the feminists were raising, and in particular the question of reproduction, the question of the roots of the oppression of women, in a different way from not only the mainstream liberal feminist, but also many socialist feminists as well. We, in fact, elaborated a theory that in some very rough outline, I've worked and much more on it over the years, but in some very rough outline still inspire my political and intellectual framework. And that theory basically tried to, at the same time, look at the roots of gender oppression or gender exploitation, but also rethink Marxism in a different way, rethink capitalism, in a different way that Marx had proposed. And this process starting from a redefinition of what reproduction is, what housework is. And fundamentally, the theory ran in along the following line. We basically argued that the reason, the most important reason, why women in the history of capitalist society have been subordinated to men, have occupied a position of lesser social power than men, and has been not the fact that they have been confined to activities in the division of labor that have been less important than men's, but rather than the activities to which they have been confined, have been devalued and have been primarily unwaged. In other words, we argued that the reason why women in capitalism have been discriminated again has been related to the fact that they've been primarily confined to reproductive labor, to labor that reproduces the workforce, and that this labor has been systematically devalued in capitalism by the fact that it has been unwaged. This, in a way, was a Copernican revolution, if you want, from the point of view theoretically and also politically, because it really turned the table from the point of view of many, many theoretical analyses of housework, domestic labor. It turned the table because it basically argued that far from being marginal work, reproductive work, domestic work, is possibly the most important work that exists within the sphere of capitalist production, being the labor that produces the workforce and reproduces on a day-to-day basis the capacity for people to work. So we argue that actually reproduction, what we generally call reproductive work, it's the pillar of the capitalist organization of work. And the fact that it has been devalued, the fact that it has been not recognized as work, has been directly related to the wageless condition of this labor, to the wageless condition of this activity. Now, out of this change, out of this shift in theoretical perspective, has come a whole rethinking of what capitalism is, what the wage and the wage relation is, how it functions, that I think has been extremely important, not only to understand the position of women in contemporary capitalist society, but and the history of capitalist society, but also to understand capitalism itself. And I'm going to try to say it, to give some of the basic elements of this rethinking in a schematic way. No, I've not finished. I'm just thinking some water. Okay. Yeah, I think actually it's been extremely important, this change of perspective, because it has enabled us to see a number of important essential element concerning the nature of capitalism. First of all, it has solved some of the mystery in terms of women's oppression, women's subordination, right? Showing that in fact the value condition of this work is being the root of women's dependence of men, economic dependence of men, and also has been the reason why, you know, housework has been completely naturalized. You know, the fact that this work has been done without, not for a wage, and therefore in a society that equates work with wages, right, it has appeared as a fact of nature, as a natural resource, right? And therefore it has been naturalized as women's labor. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, it's demonstrated that the wage, we began to see that the wage is not simply a certain amount of money, but the wage is a whole way of organizing society. And in particular, it's a way of organizing divisions among workers, organizing labor hierarchy. And it's a way also by which capitalism has delegated power to certain sectors of the workforce over others. And so in a sense has been able to rule, maintain its hegemony through a system of indirect rule, right? So that, for example, white male workers have been able to have the control over the body and the labor of women, which means that through the white wage male worker, capitalism has been able also to command the labor of a whole population of unwaged workers, right? So in that sense, this perspective has also changed very fundamentally our understanding of capitalist society. You know, for instance, showing that capitalism exploits a much broader pool of unpaid labor than is usually recognized. No, that, in fact, behind the appearance of being a type of society, a type of system that is built on contractual relationships, that is built on wages and wage relation fundamentally, that actually at the bottom, at the center of capitalism, it's a tremendous amount of unpaid work, right? And second, the much of this unpaid work, you know, has been made invisible, has been, again, naturalized by the fact of it being wage. and also that the devaluation of reproductive work, which fundamentally means the devaluation of the work that reproduces human life, right, is something that is fundamental, essential to capitalist society, because we came to understand why capitalism would have organized this type of work in this fashion. You know, why this bifurcation in capitalist society between, you know, the work for the market, production of commodities, production of workers, bifurcated and by the line of the wage and lack of it, right? Except that this is a very convenient system to reduce the cost of labor, right? To, in fact, produce workers, produce labor power at a very reduced capacity, right? So, in a way, this began the process where, starting from an analysis of gender relation, we actually move, and certainly this was true for myself, right, to a rethinking of capitalism from the point of view of reproduction. In other words, I become less interested or more interested understanding, you know, what capitalism is by looking at it from the point of view of the reproduction of life, not only from the point of view of women as such, but from the point of view of, you know, how capitalism deals with the reproduction of people and of workers. Now, this is the framework that, I want to add something else that is important, that this kind of perspective was very crucial, in my view, politically, for women in the movement, because it was very liberating, you know, to be able to see that many of the relationships, the family relationships, sexual relationship, relationship between women and men, were actually, as we began to call them, relations of production. You know, relations that had to do with a particular type of production. They have to do with, for example, the needs of the labor market, et cetera, et cetera. Because fundamentally, they were geared to the production of laborers. It was very liberating because it became possible to think of refusing those relationships, of fighting against them, without suffering the immense amount of guilt the women have always felt whenever they have wanted to refuse housework, whenever they have felt oppressed by the kind of relationship they experienced in their family, in their relationship with men. And in a way, it became a process also of denaturalizing femininity, denaturalizing this, expectation that have been placed upon women, like seeing the worker beneath the housewife, seeing that when we speak of housework, we speak of work, not something that is a part of women's psychological makeup, right? Had a tremendously liberating effect, because it began to be possible to see that in refusing this work, right, we could also liberate not only ourselves, at least refusing this work, refusing those aspects of this work that were commanded upon us, that were geared towards the discipline and the production of a workforce, right? And of course, there is a very, very, very complex situation here, right? Because reproductive work has always two sides. You know, it reproduces our life, but also it reproduces us as workers. And so it's a work in which you're always living a tension. And I think beginning to see, you know, the capitalist character of this work, how this work has been constructed in capitalism, enabled us also to see this continuous tension that exists because you're reproducing labor power, the capacity to work, but at the same time, you're also reproducing the individual. The two are not separate. Labor power is not something that exists, that subsists, right? But only exists in the living individual. So in reality, you are reproducing human beings, but you're also reproducing work at the same time, and there's a tension there, which I think parents confront every day, right? What you're reproducing your children for, right? What objectives, you know, their happiness, their joy, their full satisfaction, the fulfillment of all their capacities, or are you beginning to train them because, after all, there's a labor market there that they have to fit, that they have to confront, and which means that a certain discipline is required or a certain particular prescription because a certain type of work has to be produced. So this problematic, I think, was a problematic that became possible to confront, starting from this perspective. In any case, this was the framework that I used to then look back into history, at the history of capitalism. And there was Caliban and the Witch was mentioned, Rudy mentioned Caliban and the Witch, and this book came out precisely from my desire to understand how historically capitalism had actually constructed these roles. In other words, at which point, by which processes, by which developments, for example, a figure like the figure of the full-time housewife with certain requirements, certain expectations, that was always presented to us as eternal, right, as woman's nature. How, in fact, could we see, for example, going back into history, could we detect moments in which policies, developments that actually would have led to the construction of these figures. And in fact, this involved for me a whole journey back into history, back into the Middle Ages, back to the rise of capitalism. And there's no time tonight to touch upon that, but certainly it became very, very clear to me that there were important turning points historically. The great witch hunts of the 16th, 17th century were one of the major turning points, not the only one, but certainly a very fundamental one, that basically began, opened up the process of the construction of a new type of femininity, of new type of relationship with men, and certainly a new organization of reproduction in the sense that in pre-capitalist society where you don't have any separation between use value and exchange value, where much of the production that takes place is for subsistence, you don't have separation between women and men as profound as you later have in capitalism, which is the reason why every time you have in any society, and colonialism has been a very classical example, in any society you have an expansion of capitalist relation, you see that the position of the woman, you know, is degraded, you know, suffering. I see many heads saying, yes, it's a very well-known and documented historical anthropological fact, right? That in fact you can actually see, and I was able to document it by the 16th, 17th century, a kind of bifurcation in what we call the economy, in the structure around whereby the economy becomes structured between two different spheres, right? Spheres that recognize as work, as important for the accumulation of wealth, for the production, for the market, and the other sphere that begins to be submerged, to become invisible, and to become completely feminized, and is the sphere of the reproduction of life, the reproduction of the workforce. Right? And throughout this process, you also begin to see the construction of new models of femininity, starkly at odds with for example, the models that have prevailed in the Middle Ages. I will leave it here, but certainly only to, I will only add that in that way, I began a process also of rethinking Marx, rethinking not only his account of reproduction of the workforce, but also his account of primitive accumulation, of the rise of capitalism, and show that, for example, primitive accumulation did not consist only in the expulsion of the peasantry from the land, which is what Marxists claim, but primitive accumulation, which was for Marx the process that it's gave impulse, you know, to the rise of capitalism, you know, was fundamentally also, you know, consisted also of, for example, the witch hunts and this bifurcation of the economy that I was referring to. But I'm going to leave the 16th century aside and instead, in the time, let me see how much I have left. Okay, still good. Yeah. I want to say that the framework that I was describing before is also the framework I've used to look at, particularly in this book, at the restructuring of the global economy that took place in the starting in the late 70s and is still ongoing. I have to say that because I looked at this restructuring from the point of view of reproduction, using this term in a broad sense, I was one of the early critics of the tendency that certainly was very strong through the 80s and even into the 90s to interpret globalization, to interpret against the reorganization of global economic relation from the point of view of the deterritorialization of industry, relocation of industry, that is from the point of view of what occurs, of what has occurred to the process of production. In other words, it became clear to me that far more important than the deterritorialization of production, in fact, a precondition for that process, was something much more important, which was a sort of return of primitive accumulation in the form of a massive worldwide attack on people's means of reproduction, whether in the form of land expropriation or in the form of the increasing dismantling of the so-called welfare state, or including the precarization of labor, certainly the capacity that capitalism has had, you know, in the 90s, through the 80s and 90s, and that process is still continuing under our own eyes. What is happening in Greece, for example, in Spain, in fact, is part of that process, is structural adjustment, primitive accumulation, you know, revived, was precisely the ability to make available millions and millions of people for a more intense process of exploitation. And that, in a way, what we were witnessing, right, was, you know, again, the attempt, you know, to degrade for millions of people the conditions of their reproduction so that on a global scale, you know, labor power could be, in fact, immensely reduced in its cost and made available again for more intense forms of exploitation. So this, again, there's many things that I would like to add here, but I don't know. I don't think I have the time, but I'd like to say that I've been very critical coming from this perspective, for example, of analyses that have stressed or place the accent on the, you know, the cognitive capitalism, who has argued, as for example Negri and Hard have done, that what we have witnessed, it's a new form of capitalism that more and more relies not on the exploitation of labor, but relies on the introduction of technology and science into the production process, and that, in fact, we are moving towards a system in which production becomes more and more immaterial, in the sense of production of immaterial values, immaterial state of beings. I'm very critical of this theory. I think that, in fact, not only physical production is still fundamental, but first of all, that when you look at the capitalist accumulation organization of work system from the point of view of reproductive work, you see that the physical and the emotional, the affective, the cognitive, and the physical cannot be separated. In fact, reproductive work is an outstanding example of how it's really impossible to draw a line between the material and the immaterial. Right? And, you know, in fact, in that sense, even utopias build on the idea that one day the machines will do all the work for us and we'll have a kind of, you know, utopian world, a model more or less on Marx's vision in the last section of the Grundrisse, where he describes, you know, how at a certain stage of capitalist development, the worker becomes the supervisor of the machine, and the machine will do most of the work, right? And socially necessary labor will be immensely reduced. That beautiful dream that so many people have been inspired by actually ignores that there is a huge amount of work. It's called reproduction that cannot be mechanized, right? You cannot mechanize child raising. And you cannot mechanize, you know, the care for people, except at a tremendous cost. I know there are some attempts now. There are people, you know, I know that in Japan they have created nurse bots and even love bots, right? That you have these mechanical lovers that you can actually program in so many different ways. But I don't think that we really want that, you know, to move in that direction. Okay, there are certain points I want to make before, and I know I have to do it very schematically, but I want to say that the process that I have described, right, as fundamental to the restructuring of the global economy, the process that has, in a sense, in different ways, depending on the regions, and depending on the power relations on the ground, right, that has launched a tremendous attack on people's means of subsistence, has also had as a consequence, and in fact as a sentence, more than as a consequence, a practically the return of a war against women. Right? And I think we can see that in so many different areas. If I had time tonight, I would just expand on that, but I only want to mention a few. I think that this war and the crisis of reproduction that is being generated is particularly visible in what many have called the third world, but is not limited to that. I want to say that as part of the drive that capitalism is making to engulf every aspect of life. And this, of course, has peaked with the neoliberal turn. Right? We have also seen an attack on women, because women have been the main subject of reproductive work, and they've also been those who have been more responsible for their communities, and therefore they've been in the forefront, really, of the defense of their communities, their lands, their waters, their forests. And I will return to those themes in a later in my discussion. So that because women also have been more dependent on the commonwealth, the natural commonwealth, access to land, you know, access to fuel, to woods for fuel, not having access to monetary incomes, they have been also more interested, more committed in struggling, you know, to defend these resources, you know, from basically the advance of the corporate world, which has come down in the 90s to this day on the third world. You're an anthropologist. I don't have to tell you that. That there is now an assault on basically, you know, the waters, forests, and lands of the world, which is unprecedented even in the colonial period. Okay. Now, in relation to the effects on women, I want to mention two in particular that I think are very important. And unfortunately, I don't think they are receiving enough attention. First of all, the attack on subsistence farming and practically a whole range of subsistence activities, but subsistence farming first of all. There is, as you know, there is now a corporate drive in Africa, Latin America, parts of Asia, right, to basically commercialize, you know, every piece of land that is available. You know, the drive comes from mining companies. It comes from agribusiness, agrofuel. And, but beyond that, beyond the specific interest of the particular companies, there is a major, major drive to actually put an end to any form of activity that is not basically under the control of monetary relation. I think that the last 20 years of reports of the World Bank have been very, very telling in this regard. You know, if you look at some of the reports, for example, the one in 2009, well, first of all, the World Bank has seen it as its own mission to privatize the lands of the earth, right? To make sure that, you know, the lands are firmly in corporate hand and used for commercial purposes. But this has escalated, and of course, the drive for individual titling has been part of that process. Also, the drive for legal reform, so that the only kind of type of tenure that will be recognized, you know, will be private tenure at the expense of communal forms of tenure, which are still until 50 years ago, still sizable parts of the globe were under communal land ownership, right? So the World Bank has had this as its mission for a long time, but now the drive to foreclose any type of subsistence is really reaching its peak, and it's really targeting women in particular, who to these days are the largest number of subsistence farmers across the globe, right? And very interesting for anthropologists. You know, the ideology that the bank has used increasingly has been the theory of Hernán de Soto, the Peruvian economist Hernán de Soto, that basically argues that money is the only creative power in society, that land is not creative, that the reason why people are poor, and here, of course, women have been targeted, women are being fingered. The reason why people are poor across the world is because they're using land for subsistence purposes to feed and shelter themselves and their communities, whereas they should only use the land as a collateral to go to the bank and get credit. the famous rural credit, get credit for it. This has been, which is a total inversion of values. It's a total inversion of value compared to traditional value. The land is, you know, the source of life, right? But now we are told, no, the money is alive. You know, money is productive. Money is creative, wherein the land is not. And of course, in the 2009 report, you know, on agriculture, the World Bank has the picture, the opening picture is that of a woman. And she's a farmer and she is bent. It's really a picture of backwardness. It's really a vilification of women. You know, she's bent on a hoe. She's trying to scratch some earth, right? Obviously in a very futile effort to grow some food, to get something from the earth. Whereas subsistence farmers have made the difference between life and death for millions of people. Because in situation in which country upon country was being structurally adjusted and tremendous austerity programs were imposed and devaluations so stiff were imposed that from one hour to the next the currency was changing. Like the fact that women still had some access to land and could be engaged in subsistence farming made actually a big difference for many, many people. Right? But nevertheless, this image is now vilified because there is clearly a drive, you know, that is visible worldwide to not allow, you know, regular human beings to have access to resources that can make them independent, that can give them some form of self-sustenance and make them independent from the corporate world, from capitalist relation, you know, and from a life where everything becomes geared to one form or another of exploitation. I know I may seem very extreme, but actually I think it's common sense. By looking at the picture of the world, it's very difficult to draw any different conclusion. The second attack, it's also, which it's very much in line with what I was describing before. You know, as an attack on this subsistence activity is through the organization of microfinance and microcredit, which has really been a plague. And I think I can say this with comfort because now I've seen the information coming from so many different areas, Latin America, Africa, Asia, beginning with Bangladesh. Beginning when Bangladesh, there is a beautiful book by Lamia Karim called Microfinance and Its Discontents that I think it's a must. And actually, I met a woman in September at Cornell University who was doing work on microcredit in Bangladesh, and she thought that Lamia was pretty conservative. So I thought, my God, what's going on if she is conservative, right? But the picture is very uniform despite the fact that of the diverse regions in which this has been applied, but the picture is very uniform. As you know, there's been a tremendous amount of learning that organizations like the World Bank and the great cohort of NGOs that it has recruited had service that they have learned. They have learned, for example, that social relation can be a capital. They have learned that the poorest can be very creative. I'm afraid that a few anthropologists have been recruited to this job, you know, because the enthusiasm about how the poorest can survive and how the poor are so creative after all, which they are in many cases, has also been used to, in fact, basically extend the network of monetary relation to all kinds of activities by which women had been able to, in a way, escape complete dependence on the market. And as you know, Mikkel Charity is given to the group, is given mostly to women explicitly because women are more controllable. And it's never, there's now a body of documentation, international documentation showing that it has not really lifted, you know, the women out of poverty. The only one who are, quote, empowered are those who are in fact policing the different groups. They are the ones who get empowered. But in fact, it has brought not only more economic debt, more economic poverty, but it's also brought a whole level of social disintegration that is quite frightening. Because in order to force, you know, women to pay, you know, and given that, the money is given to the group and every member is responsible for repayment, in order to force women to pay, all kinds of very, very intimidating tactics are used. You know, in some cases they're putting, for example, in many places they put the picture of the women on the front of the banks, right, so that they are publicly shamed. And also apparently there's a whole ethnography of shame. There's an anthropologist called Julie Eliakar that used to teach at New York University. Maybe some of you know her. And she has done a study. You know, she was actually involved in Egypt. She was actually doing research in Egypt. And she has a very, very interesting analysis of how this was organized in Egypt. But she really speaks of an ethnography of shame in terms of, studies that are being conducted in different places of, how do you shame people into paying back their debts, which is not the same in every culture, right? So there are codes that you need to appropriate. And so there's actually studies being done in that direction. But where shame does not work, then physical violence comes in. So women's houses have been broken into. Whatever they have is being appropriated. And there are now stories about actually women within the groups themselves of which they're part of, doing violence to each other, right? And this is a whole area that is very important to look at. And in a way, this escalation of violence connected to basically new forms of economic regime and to the extension of monetary relationship also brings in another attack on women that is ongoing, which I think deserves much more attention that has been paid to because it's extremely frightening, which is the return of witch hunting in so many parts of the world, whether it is Africa. And again, I'm sure that you are familiar with it because some anthropologists actually have done some studies, Le Komarov, for example, in relation to South Africa, Paul Gesquiere, in relation to Cameroon. Even though I must say that Paul Gesquiere has been very interested in, how the occult has returned in the political language of the political class, but has been much less interested in seeing instead how what really motivated and what are the forces, the social forces behind, these many, many attacks and assault on women, usually older women, usually women who have no social power, usually women who live alone. And the phenomenon is not a small phenomenon. I mean, for Africa alone, we have figures that reach 30,000 women as of the last times that I was checking these statistics. And what are those statistics? Because these are the recorded cases. So, but this to give an idea of the magnitude of the phenomenon. And, I have a theory that, and I think it's corroborated by some evidence. I'm not alone in this theory, that this is very much connected to this process of enclosure that is taking place. It's very much connected to the process of expropriation of people, entire villages from their land, from the attack on communal land ownership, and of course, witchcraft accusation, perfect, right, to disaggregate community, to turn people against each other, to disseminate climates of fear, suspicion. Now, why, to conclude, why this is taking place? Clearly this is taking place, and I want to return to what I was saying before. Also because, I mean, this war on women, and also because, as I say, women have been the ones who, in the neoliberal attack against, you know, people's means of livelihood, have been the ones who have been the most important subject protagonist of resistance. And I will go further to say that actually there are those who, in response to this neoliberal attack, have also those who have become all kinds of practices on the ground of reproduction to create new forms of social cooperation, new type of commons that, in fact, have enabled, you know, people to survive, have enabled people not only to survive, but actually to begin to transform their society. You know, whether they've been picketeras, whether they have been, in occupying land, doing urban farming, taking over any piece of land in the capitals of Africa that they could utilize and farm, you know, for their families and for non-commercial purposes. Or they have been those who have organized Ola Comunes and to stretch the budget of that they had. You know, so in many different ways, I mean, women today are the ones who are transforming the reproduction process. And they are transforming in a way that is more collective, more cooperative, and in a way opens the way to the creation of a different society. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I hope I didn't go too much over. Yeah? Good, good. Thank you. Sure.
Thank you very much, Sylvia. I'd like to, we're not at questions yet. We have a discussant for a few minutes, so please hold your question. Thank you. Our discussant is Sophie Bjork-James, who is a doctoral student at CUNY Grad Center in Anthropology.